Hey, welcome along. It is 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday, North American Eastern Time. That means it's election day in the United States. Rather a drizzly, rainy, miserable election day in my corner of far northern New England. I hope it's more agreeable where you are. Vote early, vote often. If you are in the United States, 4 o'clock here, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. That's 10 o'clock Western Europe, 11 o'clock in the Middle East, midnight in Moscow, and Wednesday in the rest of the planet, wherever you are. This is another edition of our Clubland Q&A, where we take questions from Mark Stein Club members all around the globe. Before we get to those, I don't actually have it. Normally at this point, it's already started. they start to leak out dodgy exit polls in order to depress turnout in the late voting parts of the country in the western states. They always do this. We had this in 2004. My favorite time was these exit polls was 2004, because in the run-up to the presidential election that year, which was Bush versus John Kerry, at some point somebody had said, this is patently absurd. Obviously, Bush is loathed and Kerry is going to win. And I said, okay, if you're right and I'm wrong. And the guy had said, why do these pundits never actually put anything behind their stupid predictions? So I said, okay, if you're right, I'll quit. I'll never say another word about American politics. I'll just do ballet criticism or whatever for now on. And I'd said this in The Spectator. And the the exit polls began being leaked, showing that John Kerry had pulled off an incredible victory over George W. Bush in 2004. So that was like about this time in the afternoon, which was 9 p.m. in London, where at the traditional U.S. Embassy election night party in Grosvenor Square. It's not in Grosvenor Square now, because they, as Trump was saying in some press conference the other day, they got rid of their desirable U.S. Embassy in the heart of Mayfair and moved to some dump on the fringes of town, and it cost them, you know, whatever it was, $37 billion to put up the new embassy there. Anyway, this was when they still had the desirable Grosvenor Square location, and the party's in full swing, and everybody's drinking and dining and dancing, and they're saying, my God, have you seen these exit polls? John Kerry's defeated George W. Bush. And my colleagues at The Spectator, I'm reliably informed, were all gloating and laughing because I'd promised to resign from The Spectator. So they're all ordering extra magnums of champagne and toasting the demise of Mark Stein because of those lousy exit polls. Well, Mark Stein is not dead. The demise did not occur. These exit polls are just there to mess with your head, so pay no attention to them. We don't know whether it's going to be a blue wave or a red wave. And realistically, it's not going to be any kind of wave. Whoever comes out on top, it's going to be red trickle or blue trickle. And the way it works is that a red trickle would be very good because you're beating the odds. Normally, the party that holds the White House loses ground in the midterms. So a red trickle would be impressive. A blue trickle presents great danger, because even if the Democrats take the House narrowly, they will start investigations into all kinds of nutso activities. So if you have questions on that, we can't actually answer. We're not going to get into stuff about, you know, who's going to take this or that district in Ohio, although if anything comes through, I will mention it. But if you've got questions on the broader themes behind the election, such as I was talking about with Tucker Carlson last night when we were talking about the business of nationalism undergirding the election, then I'm happy to take questions on that. And also on free speech, which we discussed in a big free speech forum on the Mark Stein Show on Friday. that I greatly enjoyed with Kathy Schadel and Tal Bachman and Andrew Lawton. If you haven't seen that, you should see it because it's a good deal of fun. I will talk about the election. You want to hear my reaction to the election? Get up early and listen to WIBX 9:50 a.m. That's your Rush station in Utica, New York. I'm going to be joining Bill Keeler tomorrow morning on WIBX First News with Keeler in the morning. It's just a little after 7:30, around about 7:35, 7:40. And I will be talking to Bill on WIBX about tonight's election results. And a little later, after 8 o'clock, I'll also be on WSYR, which is the Rush affiliate in Syracuse, New York, with Dave Allen on Dave Allen's morning show, and also talking about the election results. So that's WIBX, WSYR tomorrow morning, which will be kind of promoting my little tour of Pennsylvania and Western New York with Dennis Miller. I want to say a couple more things before we get to your question. I'm like taking a bit of a leisurely introduction today. I wanted to say a couple more things. Last time I was here, it was the day my beloved cat TJ, who is in our video for Feline Groovy, she only talks that way to the cat, had died that morning, and I was very shaken up by it. And I want to thank all those people who sent me really very nice and touching messages about it. I wouldn't have mentioned it except that because TJ's in the video, he was a professional colleague of mine, like Rush or Tucker or Dennis Miller, and I certainly put him in that pantheon as one of the greats. And thank you for all your kind messages. I'm sort of surprised at how much I miss his physical absence in my life. It still sort of depresses me a little when I wake up in the morning. That's that. But I thank you for your kind messages on that. The other good news for those who follow the boring suit with Carrie Katz and CRTV. They're the guys who tried to steal TJ's cat tree, by the way. It's actually the subject of ongoing litigation, that cat tree. That's how stupid and tedious CRTV and Carrie Katz are. But they actually have thrown in the towel on about half of the first suit, if you recall, when they sued me and they lost and they were ordered to pay damages. They actually wired some money while I was on a plane. I think it was yesterday. They wired some money. They've thrown in the towel. They've got there's three current suits, really. And I guess the way to look at this is that they've thrown in the towel on half of one of the three suits. So there's really only two and a half to go. The rest of that first suit is going to the appellate court, and the other two are staggering on in, I think one's in federal court and one's in arbitration. You know, who the hell? I'm falling asleep just thinking about it. But the legal term for all this is partial satisfaction. And if you remember a few months ago, I picked We Are the Champions and Oh Happy Day as a couple of our songs of the week on Sunday. And Carrie Katz, who's nothing if not totally solipsistic, was convinced that those songs were getting at him, that I was slyly suggesting that because he's a big loser who blew his lawsuit against me, that We Are the Champions. I was somehow suggesting that we are the champions and that I had no time for losers and that he was the loser I had no time for. So he sued me about We Are the Champions and Oh Happy Day. So now that we have, in legal terms, received partial satisfaction, I'm going to be very careful not to pick I Can't Get No Satisfaction as our song of the week, because he will then sue me, because it shouldn't be I Can't Get No Satisfaction. I should be singing I Just Got Some Partial Satisfaction. Anyway, that's the news on the front with all that rubbish. Okay, on to your questions. Matthew McMilliams writes, Mark, whether or not one believes in nationalism, it is necessary in politics to have a sense of the national mood or the sense of the people. On both the Democrat and Republican side, there is no shortage of pundits predicting absolute victory for their side, or at least a frustration for the opposing side based on a particular reading of that national mood. Obviously, I have my own hopes for the outcome of the day's elections. But as I sit here, I can't tell you what will happen. How is it that there can be such certainty about two so diametrically opposed views of how the elections will turn out that are necessarily based on two opposing views of the national mood? I'm speaking, of course, of the opposing predictions of a blue wave and a red wave and the various theories of how the other side doesn't get what they want based on various issues, whether it's Trump's tweets or the treatment of Kavanaugh. Is this just wishful thinking by one side or the other, or have the two factions become so isolated that they cannot accurately assess what the other, or indeed the nation as a whole, is thinking? Well, that's like a super interesting question, Matthew. It's not a red wave or a blue wave. It's a red trickle or a blue trickle. You have a hyper-partisan nation in which certain aspects of the real world have become more partisan. They're far more what they used to call landslide counties now than there were in the 1970s, say. So in the 1970s, there was far more winnable turf. The way it works in the United States now is there's actually both sides write off large parts of the map, and then they argue about turnable slivers of wherever's left. That's why it's not a wave, red wave, blue wave, whatever wave. It's actually just trying to turn enough people, a small number of people, one way or the other, and that will make the difference between Trump, for example, being able to put the Russia investigation behind him and get on with his agenda, or Trump being tied up in investigations unto the end of time and maybe facing impeachment. And I think as far as pundits are concerned, they actually generally meet very few of the people whose mood they're reading. That's to say, most punditry takes place within a very few, at the highest level, that is, at a very few select enclaves. Those people don't actually encounter many ordinary people. It used to be the great cliche of journalism. It used to be that you never put in a story, I was in wherever it was, and my taxi driver said to me, because it's to anyone who reads that, they understand that you're a big elite person who jets in, and the only ordinary person you encounter is the taxi driver who takes you from the airport to the Ritz-Carlton, wherever you happen to be. So you should never put, as I happened to be talking to a taxi driver the other day, he was a delightful fellow and he turned out to be a Somali and he told me this, that and that. Because what you're doing is you're actually advertising that you live in a world where you no longer have any contact with ordinary people except your taxi driver and your cleaner and your gardener and all the rest of it. And Thomas Friedman, one of the reasons why he's such an awful, unreadable writer is because he's actually always talking about the drive. He's like flies around the world for the New York Times, and he's always talking about the driver who drives him to his hotel in Shanghai, the driver who drives him to his hotel in Tashkent, the driver who drives him to his hotel in Port Moresby or wherever. That's the only ordinary people he meets. And he actually meets more ordinary non-Americans than he ever meets ordinary Americans. So I don't believe these people actually see the world they report on very much. And I think that's actually a big problem because it enables you to self-create a bubble much more effectively than it used to be. Almost anywhere is actually quite interesting. I mean, I was talking with Tucker about nationalism. Tucker, I think in the introduction, somewhere in the course of the show, he mentioned that if Arizona and Texas turn blue, that's actually because the Democrats imported people to vote blue, to vote Democrat. And that's why demographics are important. Because if, say, for example, there's two arguments about Texas. The one argument I heard from a couple of Mark Steyn cruisers from Texas, we had dinner and one night on the cruise, and they were talking about Ted Cruz, no relation to the Mark Steyn cruise, completely different cruises. But Ted Cruz, and I was saying, is Ted really in trouble in Texas, and what does that mean? And they were suggesting that it was a one-off thing, because Ted, him personally, was not very popular. There's two theories on this. If Ted Cruz loses, it's either because people don't like Ted Cruz, and otherwise Texas is Texas. And then the other theory is that there have been great demographic changes in Texas, and Texas is now turning from red to purple, and it will eventually become blue. And when Texas becomes blue, then the Republican Party is done, because the Democrats start off with a huge advantage in that they, in the Electoral College every 4 years, because they have California and they have New York. If they also have California and New York and they also have Texas, then there's no more Republican Party. They'll never elect another president. That's the way it is. But generally speaking, it's the sliver in the it's a very small number, thousands of people in a few swing districts across the country that will determine the fate of the election today. And by definition, they're the least partisan people, because they're people who voted for Obama and then they voted for Trump. You know, they voted John Boehner and then they voted for Nancy Pelosi. You know, by definition, those people are the least partisan in the country. And figuring out what's going on with them is actually a very particular skill set. Timothy McDonald says, "Dear Mark, I'm sure you've already read that someone tried to steal or destroy the Magna Carta. I'm somewhat astonished you haven't written about it yet or spoken about it on Tucker. The attack occurred on Thursday, October 25th, and today we only know the following. We know the name of the tourist from Louisiana, Matthew Del Cambre of New Iberia, who helped tackle him as the accused man ran out of Salisbury Cathedral with his hammer. We know that the accused is already out on bail until November 20th. We have a picture of the damaged display case that held this copy of the Magna Carta. We know how long it took for the authorities to arrive at the scene. When seconds mattered, the police were only 12 minutes away." Oh, now, come on, Timothy. That's actually quite good for the English constabulary. "But it is now Tuesday, November 6th, and we still don't have a name, picture, or physical description of the accused. There is no news report about the crime that contains pertinent information after October 27th. Apparently, CNN, New York Times, NBC, CBS, ABC hasn't called Mr. Del Cambre up and asked for a physical description of the accused. What troubles me is that in this day and age, Magna Carta no longer ensures basic liberty, but apparently ensures a near total media blackout about anyone who tries to destroy it. If only the accused had a van that was heavily bumper stickered with ideological quotes, which would give people a clue as to his motivation. But alas, no manifesto, no follow-up seems to apply here. Just move along. Where is the media on this story, and what have you found out?" You know, Timothy, I vaguely remember seeing something about that. I'd sort of, to be honest, I'd completely forgotten about this. But you're right. You know, I mentioned this with regard to Elisabeth Sabadich-Wulff, who was the Austrian lady who was prosecuted for saying that Mohammed was a paedophile. And the judge convicted her in Austria on the basis that, yes, Mohammed married Aisha when she was 6 years old, and he didn't consummate the marriage until 9, and he stayed with her, he stayed married to her, until she was over the age of consent. He was married to her until Aisha was 18, when he died, right? So therefore, according to the Austrian court, you can't call Mohammed a paedophile because he didn't dump Aisha as soon as she ceased to be a minor. This is how European jurists now have to think. And I'm always interested because of these stupid cases with, he doesn't like it when I mention his name, Carrie Katz. So I'm going to call him the Right Dishonourable Sir Scofflaw McDeadbeat. And then he won't know that I'm really talking about Carrie Katz. So anyway, the Right Dishonourable Sir Scofflaw McDeadbeat, because of these cases, I always pay great attention to judges' arguments because I like hearing what they say in my case. And to see these judges torture and torment themselves to find an explanation as to why you can't say that a man who deflowers, which is a fancy word for rape, deflowers a 9-year-old girl, a paedophile, is incredible. And I mentioned that Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf, who's been unfairly convicted of this, that when she took it to the European Court of Human Rights, she's just billed as ES, because they have this thing now, increasingly in continental courts, police, media reports. They used to... At one time, they used to be coy about who was mixed up in any kind of criminal act, any kind of crime, because you'd be talking about a rape victim, say, and you want to protect the name of the 15-year-old girl who's been raped. So her name isn't put in the paper. We now have a thing where increasingly in Britain and in Europe, the perpetrator isn't mentioned. You have cases like Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf's case at the European Court where she actually is the victim in that, but her name isn't mentioned, so you can't sort of put a face to it. You can't actually, it's not a real individual, and so you don't actually see her individual, even as a great injustice is done to her, a double injustice is done to her in that her individuality is erased by the court. Then you have this other thing now where the anonymity, the spreading anonymity, and it's getting worse and worse in the British and European press, so that at some point the newspapers and the news reports will just say something happened last night somewhere to somebody, but we can't tell you any more than that. That's how it's getting. There's no reason at all. Why is a man who attempts to destroy Magna Carta, why do we not know who he is? Because the press is concerned. Magna Carta is the great embodiment of liberty in the English world. It's where the barons got the king in a tent, in a field, in a meadow, a Runnymede, in 1215, and they said, now listen, pal, you're a king, but even a king must bow to the law. So it's a foundational document of contemporary attitudes to liberty throughout the English-speaking world. And so what does it mean when someone wants to destroy it, that he thinks that's all bunkum? That whatever's driving him is a contempt for this document. That seems a reasonable assumption. Okay, well, can we see who it is then who tried to destroy Magna Carta? Can we get a name? Oh, no. No, no, no. For some reason, we know everything else. We know the name, as Timothy says, we know the name of the guy from Louisiana, Matthew from New Iberia, the guy who helped tackle him. We know everything about the case except the alleged perpetrator, which is interesting, isn't it? A lot of that about. Toronto police tried to do it with the guy who went bananas there on the streets a couple of weeks back. They tried to do it with the hockey bus, the school hockey bus crash in Canada. They consciously... And this is what the problem with it. We see it around the world now, where the police collude in misleading the public or just leaving the public in the dark because the facts of the case are inconvenient to the lies our rulers tell us. John Wilson writes, so when the Democrats fail to gain the House, what will be their next step on their escalator of violence Where does it all end? I don't know about Democrats failing to gain the House. Everyone's attaching great significance to the way Ronna McDaniel seems to be throwing in the towel on the House. Again, that's head fakery. If you're listening to this in the West, vote. Still go out and vote. This is all rubbish. The stuff that the media put out on the afternoon of Election Day has no purpose except to depress Republican turnout in places where the polling stations are still open. You know, all the energy, I heard all the energy, Peter Schiff, I heard Peter Schiff saying something about this the other day, that the energy on the left, which is a real change, is to the far left. And to the far left, where things like free speech and debate are not held in any great regard, violence is justified. Because they have redefined violence so that if you happen to produce a book that is distressing to them, you know, if you happen to walk in onto a college campus with a copy of Huckleberry Finn, they're all cowering in terror because it's a microaggression and you've demolished their safe space. And they're all traumatized by it because there's a bad word. I don't know whether you know this, and I don't want to traumatize anyone, but because there's a bad word in Huckleberry Finn. So Huckleberry Finn is violence. So if you go onto a college campus and you have a book that's got a bad word in it, or if you mention a guy who's like literally Hitler, like Churchill is literally Hitler. He's like a racist and an imperialist. Churchill is Hitler. And so if you mention a guy like Churchill on a college campus, then you've committed a microaggression, aggression. You've committed a form of violence. Mentioning Churchill, carrying around a copy of Huckleberry Finn, that's violence. So we've redefined violence on the left. But on the other hand, if you go and smash the face of someone who mentioned Churchill, or put the boot into someone who's walking around with Huckleberry Finn, then that isn't violence because you're resisting violence to restore the safe space. And this Democrat, we are getting to the stage now. And the public is largely, you can tell in the way certain stories are presented. This Bernie Sanders supporter who wanted to take out the Republican baseball team. I spoke to Steve Scalise when I was guest hosting for Rush a couple of months ago, and I began by asking him how he was. Because so many people die now that we think the two categories that you fall into are dead and alive, dead and alive. You notice when they have these, like these guys who go bananas on the sidewalks and start running down people all over Europe, or who go in and shoot up somewhere. And what people are interested in are they're sorry about the three people who are killed, but not the 15 who are injured. Or like in Nice, whatever it was, the 89 people who were killed, but not the hundreds who are injured. Those hundreds of those people are going to be living with those. Their lives are changed. And you can tell when you talk, Steve Scalise was all upbeat and all the rest of it, but the injuries he suffered will change his life forever. And nobody cares about that. Democrats were and liberal media were even saying, well, you know, yes, he shouldn't have been shot, but, yes, he shouldn't have been shot, but, yes, he shouldn't have been shot, but, he had views on this and he had views on that. The rationalization of violence, on the part of the left is going to increase, Toby Pilling writes, Mark, what do you see as a common... I'm reading the wrong question there. I'll deal with Toby's and then do the one. They're all swimming before my eyes. I really need to stop drinking before the show. Toby Pilling writes, if Trump had laid but a single brick of the wall, would he now be relishing a landslide victory? I think so. I think as I always say, people ask me about this, building the wall is not just about building the wall for the purpose of securing your border. It's also about building the wall is also to demonstrate to the people of the United States and to the world that America is still a sovereign nation and that persons elected on a particular platform are still capable of enacting that platform. So building the wall is not just about building the wall, but it's also about demonstrating that you have the will to build the wall. And that's why I say all this goes back to January 20th, 2017. In the weeks running, in the weeks between November and January, there were all these things where, you know, the blind guy who sings with Sarah Brightman, the time to say goodbye, that guy, I love that guy, the Italian tenor. And he agreed to come and sing at Trump's inauguration. And, you know, what's it to him? He's Italian. Why should he care? So he agrees to come and sing at Trump's inauguration. Immediately, the left club into a pulse. So, you know, you can't do that, you blind guy. What are you, blind? Can't you see what's going on here? And they're going to club him to a pulp. And so he pulls out and he's done. The minute all the people started pulling out, and it wasn't going to be, you know, the Kennedy inauguration or the Obama inauguration, Trump should have said, well, to hell with this. I'm a different kind of president. I'm going to be, you don't have to be sworn in with a whole, with that stupid, all the parades and all the, most of all that stuff. You don't have to do that. Coolidge was sworn in by lamplight in his family cottage in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, by his dad, who was a justice of the peace. Trump should have said, I'm a different kind of guy. I'm going to be sworn in by a justice of the peace down on the Mexican border, and I'm going to lay the first brick as I take the oath. And I think if he had done that, I think you're right that I don't know whether it would be a landslide, Toby, but I think he would certainly be in better shape in these midterms. You know, Paul Ryan leaked that he told Trump to quit yakking about immigration, and he said he should be talking about Paul Ryan's tax bill. Half the country doesn't pay federal taxes, completely unaffected by it. And a big bunch of those who are left are affected by it. You know, it's marginal. What they wanted was the recovery of American sovereignty. They don't want the Paul Ryan agenda. Nobody does. Nobody does. Nobody does. And I'm not actually saying, I'm not particularly saying anything about Paul Ryan there. I think it's legitimate to be concerned about debt and the deficit, not that Republicans ever, who profess to be concerned about it, ever do a damn thing about it. But it doesn't mean anything to people. If you're someone who earns 30 grand a year, why do you care if we go from 20 trillion in debt to 22 trillion in debt? It's above your pay grade, and all the people whose pay grade it is, the most important people in America, they don't care about the 22 trillion. If they don't care about the 22 trillion, why should a guy earning 30 grand a year care about the 22 trillion? What they cared about was the recovery of American sovereignty. Mick Wenlock writes, Mark, what do you see as a common thread between Trump's election and the Brexit vote? The reaction from both deep state entities has been exactly the same, seeking to deny the results of the votes. Do you see this behavior as a harbinger for how things will go with other countries as they turn to more populist governments? I think we are living in, if things go badly, we are beginning the age of post-democracy. Because basically, the permanent bureaucracy, the ruling class, whatever you want to call them, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in Europe, is basically saying you are free to vote as you want to vote. But if you do not vote as we think you should vote, then we will subvert the vote. Trump was duly elected as America's president, and the permanent bureaucracy boasts about how it's subverting his agenda. Brexit was voted for by the biggest number of citizens of the United Kingdom that has ever voted for anything. More people in the UK have voted for Brexit than have ever voted for anything. And yet immediately, the permanent bureaucracy and much of the political class and the media began figuring out ways to subvert the Brexit vote. In Europe, the European Commission, the Eurocratura, the permanent European bureaucrats in Brussels, if a nation state such as Austria or Hungary or Italy votes for populist governments of which they disapprove, the unelected bureaucracy in Brussels feels it has the right to attempt to subvert and nullify that vote. And we are in a dangerous, dangerous place if we think, if that trend starts to accelerate. If you tell the people that vote, I mean, we've seen people are surprised. People say, oh, Trump tweeted this, and that's what caused, that's what's causing all these bombs to be mailed to people. And Trump tweeted that, and that's what's causing people to shoot up synagogues. No, the best way to incentivize violence is to tell people that voting doesn't matter. You can vote whichever way you want, but nothing is ever going to change. And wait then till you see how much violence kicks in once people figure the logic of that. Tom says, dear Mark, do you have any opinion or read on... wait a minute, where's this question gone? It's some, do you have any opinion or read on technologies like cryptocurrencies, blockchains, and other software tools that will or might undermine some of the excesses of government? The promise is that in the same way the internet has undermined traditional media and allowed for expression outside the bounds they defined, technologies that allow for the transfer of value outside of banks and courts and other regulatory bodies will undermine the primary tools of government, hopefully for the good. This is an interesting question, Tom. This, when you say cryptocurrencies, you're thinking of things like Bitcoin. It's true, increasingly, and this is why... people, for example, people say they get rid of small coins. A lot of countries, you know, you have a penny, but they've gotten rid of the penny. And a lot of countries would like, and certainly we're approaching the stage at which they'll be able to, would like to be able to get rid of cash entirely. If you look at certain countries, for example, have already got rid of checks. So you can't just pull out a piece of paper and write, you know, pay Fred's auto $37 or whatever. And they've gotten rid of that. And they would like to make every transaction digital, electronic, so that there will be a record of it. So they will know... however small a sum it is, they will know how you spend every penny of your money. Now, obviously, they're not going to be able to track hundreds of millions, billions of people. But when they want to track you, if they decide you're a person of interest, they'll be able to track you. They'll be able to figure out every little. And they want to be able to control that. That's why there's an urge to abolish cash and get rid of checks and all the rest of it, so that they'll just be able to click and they'll be able to see exactly what it is that you've because every transaction will be electronic. And the question is whether these things like Bitcoin, which will allow you to operate outside of officialdom. Now, American, I mean, for example, if you just go back 10 years and you take about look at what happened in Europe in the wake of the 2008 crash, Lehman Brothers and all that, tons of people in Greece, Mediterranean Europe, basically, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, they emptied their bank accounts and they put the stuff in their car and they drove it to Germany and put it in German banks, which they felt was a better bet. Americans don't have the freedom to do that. Since the Fat Cat Act or whatever it's called and and similar legislation, it's extremely, I mean, again, this is one of the, this relates back to Tucker's point on nationalism. If you're an illegal immigrant working in America, taking the job of an American, undercutting wage levels of Americans, you can take the money that you make in the United States and send it to Mexico, and the United States government won't bother you one whit. You can do that all the time, with everything. But increasingly, the United States government, which operates a nationalized banking system, effectively, I mean, you've got like a zillion different banks, but they're all operating to the same federally imposed rules. And they won't let you bank anywhere else. They won't let you put your money anywhere else. As Americans know in recent years, you know, if someone from Germany wants to open a bank account in Bermuda, the Bermudans are glad to see him. If an American wants to open a bank account in Bermuda, the Bermudans don't want to know because it's more trouble than it's worth, and the non-American banks get hassled. So America is building this essentially of an extremely restrictive view of the of what we called Tom called the transfer of value outside of banks and courts and regulatory bodies. And the question with Bitcoin and other is whether you can build workarounds to that, or to take the comparison Tom made, in the same way that the internet has undermined traditional media and allowed for expression outside the bounds they defined. What Tom's just done there is he's defined the internet as it existed 10 years ago. Today, it's more boring than that because Facebook controls everything and Google controls everything. So the question is whether these alternative things like cryptocurrencies and blockchains, whether they can bubble up and become something for a while, and then the big cartel, the antitrust monopolies, they get their control on the thing again. Then, you know, as increasingly appears on the internet, it was a beautiful moment for a few years in the early 21st century. And then Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google came along and screwed the whole thing and made it boring and more controlled, made the media more controlled than it ever was in the bad old days 30 years ago when it was the New York Times, CBS, ABC, everything. Michael Covino writes, hi, Mark, did you see the recent poll Tucker highlighted on his show last night, noting that more than 25% of young people under 30 believe this nation should embrace socialism? I am 41 years old and for the life of me cannot figure why young Americans view socialism favorably. Have they not seen the hellhole that is Venezuela? Any suggestions for how we open the eyes of such young people? Thanks. Have they not seen the hellhole that is Venezuela, asked Michael. Well, Michael, that's literally true. They haven't seen the hellhole that is Venezuela. Knowing the first thing about Venezuela requires you to watch foreign stories on the news, which is few and far between in America, or pick up the foreign pages of an American newspaper, assuming anybody under the age of 30 picks up a newspaper. So no, they haven't seen the hellhole that is Venezuela, and even if they had, it wouldn't make any difference. And it comes back to something that Tucker and I sort of touched on last night, which is that identity. And nationalism, if you destroy people's, if you make nationalism a bad thing, people look for alternative identities. People want an identity. And for some people, they'll, if it's no longer, say, I'm an American, I love America, USA, USA, USA. Well, that's bad, that's nationalism. What else do you like? Well, I like being gay. Okay, then instead of going USA, 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 go, we're here, we're queer, get used to it, and be gay. And so people find an alternative. Say, well, actually, I'm not gay. What do I do? Well, what do you like? Well, I'm a bit worried about it. I'd like to save the earth. And well, then environmentalism, climate change. That can be your identity. How about you? I couldn't care less about the planet. Well, what do you like? Well, I'm a Muslim. Okay, well, then you can go around and go Allahu Akbar, and you've got an identity. And so that's all fine. That's fine, because people say, you know, can't be American, you can't be Canadian, you can't be Swedish. That's bad nationalism. So instead, be gay, be an environmentalist, be an Allahu Akbar guy. That's all identity. For the young in particular, socialism is a romance. And I think there's no doubt the energy on the Democrat side is, I think also it's the fact that if you're idle and young, and by idle I'm not saying you necessarily literally do nothing all day long, but compared to a century ago, when Americans had an eighth grade education. So basically the pattern of life in New Hampshire, where I live, was very simple. You were a kid until you were 13, grade eight. You were a kid until you were 13, then you were a grown up, then you went to work, then you died. That's it. That was life. Two phases of life. Kid till 13, working after 13, and then you die. And now we have this protracted adolescence from the age of 13, basically until just shy of 30, when everyone's... They don't do... Again, Tucker and I touched on this last night. They don't do the things that almost all functioning societies have done throughout human history. They don't work. You don't have early family formation, so people become parents later and later and later. People marry and own property later and later. What makes somebody not be a socialist? It's just actually the boringness of life. It's like getting a job and seeing how much the government takes out of your paycheck. It's like going to the bank and saying you'd like to buy your first apartment and you're going to need to borrow money and you're going to have to pay that money back. And then you go to the trouble of taking a big loan to buy the apartment, and then you figure out that you've got property taxes and you've got to pay some guy to come and do your plumbing and all that stuff is what turns somebody from a starry-eyed socialist into somebody rooted in reality. Like Mrs. Thatcher's line, the facts of life are conservative. If you defer your acquaintanceship with the facts of life until early middle age, which is the model for our society now, why be surprised that huge numbers of people under 30 embrace socialism? People want identity, when you defer the building blocks of adulthood, like home ownership, work, marriage, family, then what is, you maintain people in a state of suspended adolescence in which the romantic ideas, think of the most stupid conversations you had as a teenager at 3 a.m. when you'd all had too much to drink and you were listening to some stupid rock album and you'll start riffing about your ideas on the meaning of life and all the rest of it. We maintain people in that stage now, as I said, until early middle age. You have to come up with something. You have to have some. I mean, for most people, actually, in the old days, actually, just the nation state to a certain extent was a romantic identity. But if you say nationalism's bad, almost any other identity that replaces it will cause you more problems down the road. Laura Rosengarten writes, do you see any similarities between the ES case to Molly Norris? They're both pretty literally dehumanized, denormalized, and disappeared. And she's referring again to the Austrian lady who took her case to the European Court of Human Rights. And they said that they basically supported the Austrian court's decision to fine her for calling a man who has penetrative sex with a 9-year-old girl a paedophile. You can't say that in Europe. You can say it if don't worry. You can say it if it's like a BBC disc jockey from the 1970s, and he happens to cop a feel on Top of the Pops while Mott the Hoople are singing "Won't You Roll Away the Stone." You can say that guy's a paedophile, but if the host of Top of the Pops on the BBC that week happened to be Mohammed, you can't say whatever Mohammed does is good. Laura is comparing ES to Molly Norris, who was the cartoonist out in Seattle who started the Everybody Draw Mohammed Day after one of these other things a few years ago. And I had some correspondence with her, which some of you will have seen. It's in my book, The Undocumented Mark Stein, and we printed it at Stein Online at the time. Because she's a liberal. I say she is because I'm assuming she's still alive somewhere, although there isn't actually any evidence for that. She was a liberal when she was Molly Norris. She was a liberal cartoonist in Seattle, but an old-fashioned liberal who thought that you being liberal meant you should be able to be as jocular about Islam as you are about Christianity. And so she started Everybody Draw Mohammed Day. And a couple of weeks later, she was in the Witness Protection Program, and as her newspaper put it, quote, "there is no more Molly," unquote. And I think about her from time to time. And Laura says, because basically the US government's solution to a woman who was threatened by the goons of Islamic supremacism was to vaporize her identity. So, as her newspaper put it, quote, "there is no more Molly," unquote. And I think we see that, I think Laura's right, we see that the victims of this new totalitarianism are vaporized in their public identities. I traveled all around. Germany's the worst for this, I would say. Although Sweden's pretty bad too. I'm thinking about it, they're all pretty bad. Because, as I said, I think, here a couple of weeks ago, you know, what shocked me when I went to Rotherham in England, and I asked around and I got some contacts, and some of the girls who were the victims got back in touch with me using, you know, fake names and things, and we would meet up in hotels and bars, and then eventually they would give me their real names. And what was shocking to me was the lack of interest in them from the UK press. These towns are, it's not even just Rotherham now, it's Sheffield, it's Rochdale, it's Telford, it's Oxford, it's Newcastle. It's all over the bloody country. You can get off the train in any of these towns, and don't hire a cab because the cabs are all run for the most part by people who are in on the scam. You can just walk around the streets and ask random people. There are thousands of these girls, and the UK media totally uninterested in their stories. There is no more Molly applies all over Rotherham and all the rest. Their stories are untold. Germany was the worst because they have this habit of just using somebody's first name. And so you'd read in the story, I read in the story about somebody, a lady worked in a kebab house. And this guy had come in with a machete. And basically he thought that she was his girlfriend. And she didn't think like that. And he came in and he basically took the machete. She ran out in the street and she was, you know, she was killed, and he tried to run away and he got knocked over by a car. And I happened to be in the town in which that happened. And I was, I went and I figured out, because there's no names in any of the papers. There's no names of people who make the news. This woman basically died in anonymity. And people know her name. If you go, but people are scared because they think there must be a reason why her name's not in the paper. So I went to that kebab place where she worked and I asked about her. The guy was terrified to talk to me. I went and spoke to the place where her killer worked, which was like up the street. And immediately the woman there was initially sort of responsive. And I said, well, I want to come back and have some talk. And I gave her my mobile telephone number. And her son called me up like 10 minutes after I'd left and threatened me that the excitable young Mohammedans were going to beat the crap out of me if I came back there again. I left that town. I went to another town where somebody else had been stabbed to death for defending a girl who was being hectored by persons of a certain persuasion. Just drivel everywhere. You know, his name is gone. Nobody, the name is not, the German media are colluding in the evaporation. It's not just that you're killed again because you're anonymous in death by the consent of the German media. It's one of the most revolting phenomena I've ever seen. Michael Seth writes, Dear Mark, greetings from the Cory Booker, Bob Menendez State in New Jersey. Yeah, think about that. You might win the prize. Michael, the only two people get to be senator from any state. And some states have like 30 million people in them, like California. And other states have like 500,000 people in them, like Vermont. And so the pool of talent is a little bit more shrunken in Vermont than it is in the state of California. But how a state can have such a shrunken, shriveled, worthless, the tide went out 30 years ago, pool of talent, that the only people who get to be senator are Cory Booker and Bob Menendez. I don't know how you pull that off, Michael. That's impressive. I don't understand why people still speak in terms of Republicans winning elections, says Michael. It has been profoundly demonstrated that if Republicans are elected, their victories will be delegitimized and rejected by the opposition and their mainstream media allies. Of course, if the Democratic candidate wins, the victory is honored. Should Republicans hold this time, especially in the House, thus depriving the Democrats of their agenda for the next 2 years, does anyone actually believe that outcome will be respected? I certainly fear it will not. By the way, can't wait to see you on the adorable Deplorable Store in Wilkes-Barre next year, says Mike from Morris County, New Jersey. Did I say that right, or is it Wilkes-Barre? Is it Wilkes-Barre or Wilkes-Barre? We don't care. Dennis Miller and I are touring Pennsylvania. We're going to be in Wilkes-Barre, and then the night after that, we're going to be in Wilkes-Barre. And a couple of nights after that, we're going to be in Wilkes-Barre, which is just down the road. So wherever you are in Pennsylvania, come and see us. You can go. There's like a little banner at the top of the Stein Online page, and you can link to that. Yeah, there's only one correct answer. That twit who's head of the European Council, Junckers. Jean-Claude Junckers. At the time, he was either foreign minister or prime minister of Luxembourg. One of them. Who cares anyway? Luxembourg, it's a country that fits into your rec room. Who cares which he was? But when he said that, he was talking about some referendum on the new so-called European constitution in France or the Netherlands. And he said, and this sums up the way they think, that he goes, if it's a yes, we say we will continue. And if it's no, we say onward. In other words, he doesn't care what your answer is. If it's not the right answer, he doesn't have to pay any attention to it. And I used to think America was different about that. But in fact, America has spent the last 2 years, the permanent bureaucracy, whether you want to call them the deep state or whatever, and the media have spent the last 2 years, as Michael says, denying the results of the election. And if things go well for the Republicans tonight, that will be problematic. It'll just mean that the Russians managed to interfere in the election even more cunningly than they did 2 years ago. So we don't even know about it yet, but we should assume that they did interfere and extend Mueller's brief for another 5, 10, 20 years, however long it's going to take him to get to the bottom of whatever's going on. On the other hand, if the Democrats win, then that is a new mandate, a mandate to torment and torture the president for the remainder of his term. And it's not good, that. Delegitimizing the people's vote is not good. Andy writes, the Canadian NDP tried to get, that's the New Democrat Party, tried to get the Monk debate to cancel Steve Bannon's invitation to last week's populism debate between Bannon and David Frum. What do you think about mainstream political parties now brazenly endorsing censorship? It's sick. You're the one who should have this idea that somehow debate, one side sets the terms of the debate. Most people in the NDP, you know, I spoke about that lady, I believe she's forgotten her name right now. She's a leader of Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition in Ontario, and she talks about Bannon spewing hate. She gave a two-line soundbite to the Globe and Mail in which she used the phrase spewing hate twice. Spewing means to, you know, vomit forth. If you keep talking about people, you know, Steve Bannon is a politician. He's not like some street thug or anything. He's a politician who happens to have a different view of life than the New Democrat Party of Canada. And he's entitled to that in free societies. It's not yet a one-party state. It's not yet a one-party state. But it's becoming a one-party state of permitted opinion. And I said to John Oakley, this phrase that trips so gaily off the naysayers' lips, the ones who want to ban everything, oh, spewing hate, spewing hate, spewing hate. If you're talking about people who have a political difference with you as spewers, maybe you're the hater. Maybe if you can only see Steve Bannon as a spewer, maybe you're the hater. Maybe he's just saying something you don't want to hear and you don't have the wit to counter it. But you're the one who's actually destroying the possibility of democratic politics by talking about spewing hate. I remember a tweet at the Globe and Mail was live tweeting when I did the Monk debate with Nigel Farage, and we were up against Louise Arbour from the Supreme Court of Canada and the UN Human Rights, what was she, either Refugee Commissioner or Human Rights Commissioner, I can't remember which one, and Simon Sharma, the great BBC historian. And there's a point, everyone knows, I've told this story before, I don't want to go on about it again, but there's a point there at which the debate turned, at which both Simon and Louise made a very bad calculation. And I pushed back, and that was the moment at which you could feel it in the room, at which the room changed. Now, people who weren't in the room, including this twit from the Globe and Mail, I think Doug Saunders was his name, he was live tweeting, and he said, it's ridiculous having someone as smart as Simon Sharma having to debate a cartoon, which is what he meant by me. I'm a cartoon to him. So to him, I'm a cartoon Islamophobe, a cartoon racist, a cartoon misogynist, a cartoon homophobe. I'm a cartoon. And that's actually the problem. The problem, when I entered that room, a lot of people thought I was a cartoon because they'd read about me from people like Douglas Saunders or whatever his name is. But in that little interaction with Simon Sharma and Louise Arbour, I ceased to become a cartoon, and they saw me as a real person and listened to what I was saying. And when that NDP lady in Ontario just keeps talking about spewing hate, it's become a phrase. It's suddenly, about 10 years ago, it was like momentarily original for about 20 minutes, and then it just became a spewing hate, just became a cliche, spewing hate, because they see you as a cartoon. You can't win the debate if you think you're up against a cartoon. If you think you're up against Wile E. Coyote and he's just going to dynamite himself with his latest gizmo from Acme. If you think you're up against Yosemite Sam and he's put the dynamite in his pants again, you can't win against a cartoon. And when you just keep talking about people spewing hate, spewing hate, spewing hate, you're doing, to go back to what we were talking about with Elizabeth Sabadich-Wolf and Molly Norris, you're, by removing their humanity, by seeing them as a cartoon, you're destroying your own debating skills. That's why you want to cancel the debate rather than win it. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. One last question. Jamie Marsh says, hi, Mark. Why is it, actually two last questions. Why is it that the left's obsession with identity politics runs only one way? Here in New Hampshire, I've just voted for Eddie Edwards. You may be wondering, if you're listening in the United Kingdom, is that Eddie the Eagle, who was the world's worst ski jumper, who used to come, he was in whatever it was, the Commonwealth Games, was it, or the Olympics up in Calgary, Winter Olympics, and he came down the ski jump, he comes down on his skis, he get to the end of the ski jump, and then he just fall off the end of it. Not that Eddie Edwards. Here in New Hampshire, I've just voted for Eddie Edwards, who surely would be the state's first black congressman. But because he's the Republican candidate, chances seem likely as not that he'll get swamped under the blue wave or trickle coming our way. Shouldn't the Dems in New Hampshire be in love with this guy? But instead they'll vote for the white male candidate who otherwise they'd have no particular use for. Does identity politics apply only so long as you march in lockstep with the approved liberal orthodoxy? Yes, Jamie, that's what's fantastic about identity politics. The point about identity politics, in theory, was that who you were enabled you to live life the way you want. You could live life, the fact that you were black was no obstacle to living life to the fullest possibility of your opportunity. The fact that you were gay. But it is now, because if you're black, but you happen to be a Republican, you're no longer black. If you're a woman, but you happen to be a conservative, you're no longer a woman. If you are gay, but you happen to be conservative, you're no longer gay. You're the approved identity groups. I mean, this is the craziness of identity politics. You can have all these identities as long you can be, oh, say it loud, I'm black and proud. We're here, we're queer, get used to it. I'm trans, hear me roar. But you can only be one kind of trans, one kind of gay, one kind of black, one kind of woman. Otherwise, the minute you decide that you like the way these conservatives are talking about things, you cease to be black, gay, female, trans, whatever, and you're just another dead white male and the rest of us. That's the thing. That's the thing about identity politics. You don't even actually get your identity under that deal. AG writes, you spoke a few months ago about the Muslima waxologist who was asked to wax the nether parts of a trans woman with the full fishing tackle. Apparently the human rights complaint business is good business. Is there anything that can be done to curtail this grotesque abuse of an even more decadent bureaucracy? This trans person is suing 16 individual women for the same reason here in Canada. Yeah, that's 16. I mentioned this a few weeks before, and because, like, I should say that because the CRTV lawyers always listen to this show, and they add to their statement of claim that we've mentioned them on the show, and they keep listening to the show. And so the last time round, they did a very bad transcript, made me appear to be suggesting that Carrie Katz was the... Because if you can't get your wedding tackle waxed, if you go to 16 waxologists and they all decline to wax your wedding tackle, you've got the most unwaxed twig and berries. And this, and I'm saying, you got to sympathize with this woman, this... She's the most hirsute transgender in British Columbia. And Carrie Katz, his transcribers got all confused. And in their last statement of statements at issue, they claimed that We were saying that he was the most hirsute transgender in North America or whatever it was. I take no position on whether. I don't know that. We're still waiting for discovery on that. So we have no view on whether. So I don't want to get into the whole... I don't want to get into hirsute genitalia, which I believe is actually what the Muslima waxologist said when she said she didn't want to accept the job. So that it's like the same, the transsexual, transgender labiaplasty case. I've done all this. I know all the transgender genitalia issues. I'm an expert. I could be an expert witness in them. I may testify as my own expert. When Carrie Cat sues me for calling him a hirsute transgender, I may testify as my own expert witness. In the transgender labiaplasty case in Toronto, where the guy, there's no correct answer to these questions. The guy said he didn't want to do the transgender labiaplasty because he was only an expert in dealing with biologically female genitalia, so he had no idea what he was getting into, literally. And I've done all those cases. I know them all back to front, and I don't want to... I'm in the interest of avoiding further litigation, we will put the transgender meat and two veg to one side. Eric McGeer, one more. Eric McGeer says, Mark, I wonder if you will have time to speak a bit about the centenary of the armistice, which will occur this Sunday. I've been participating in or attending various events commemorating the end of the Great War and the disproportionate role played by Canadian soldiers in achieving the Allied victory. And we should also add, Eric, the disproportionate role played by Newfoundland soldiers who were not then part of the Dominion of Canada, but were a Dominion all of their own. But if there's one discordant note in all this, it is the lack of effort by the Canadian government, including to their shame Veterans Affairs, to make this a profound and significant day of remembrance. You have spoken about the future of countries without a mature sense of their past. And I feel that if we fail to mark this of all occasions, then what on earth will be worth honouring? It's as though we prefer to refuse the inheritance of the past and the contribution of our forebears so that we can get a few days off here and there. I'd appreciate your thoughts on what I think is the most important historical anniversary of our lifetimes. Thank you very much. Thank you, Eric. The centenary of the armistice, the day when the guns fell silent on the Western Front, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in November 1918. That centenary falls this Sunday. We will have something special for you that day here at Stein Online. And the reason we will is because I agree with what Eric said. We live in the world made by the Great War, the First World War, the order that was destroyed, the four empires that fell in Europe, the Turks, the Austrians, the Germans, the Russians. It's way beyond that. It was in the wake of that war, it's not just that we literally rebuilt the map after that war, the modern Middle East, which plagues us to this day. Those countries were all invented in the wake of the Great War. But it's also the psychological trauma caused by that war from which the West in general, Christendom, whatever you want to call it, has never recovered. We all live in the shadow of the Great War to this day. And people say, what are you talking about? I live in the shadow. What do you mean, man? I'm just like listening to my own. You don't even know it. But actually, you live in the rubble of the Great War. We all do. And 9/11 and all kinds of other things suddenly rear up and appear to come out of nowhere. But you trace their roots back, and they're to do with what was shattered in the 4 years between 1914 and November 11th, 1918. I thank you for that question, Eric. We will have something special for you at Stein Online on Sunday to mark that centenary. Thank you for all your questions. We may get to some of them in a follow-up edition of Mark's Mailbox. As I said, we will soon be learning the results of the red trickle, blue trickle, whatever kind of trickle, maybe a purple trickle, maybe an indeterminate kind of trickle. Like, you know, sometimes at your doctor, the test results aren't quite as clear as you would like. I shall be talking about that on WIBX 950 in Utica, New York, at a little after 7:30 Eastern time tomorrow. And then about 40 minutes later, 8:15-ish, on WSYR in Syracuse. You know those stations because they're both Rush affiliates. I will see you on the radio tomorrow morning. Thank you for dialing us up today, and we will see you next time.